Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter Bregan. And my guest today, whom I will introduce in about 90 seconds, is one of my favorite people on the face of the earth. So I'm really looking forward to today. Favorite person, are you there? I want to make sure we're connected.
I am here. We are connected.
We are connected. Well, just before furthering the connection, I want to announce proudly to the world that our new ECT, that's electroconvulsive therapy, our new ECT resource center is up and going. So if you've heard of somebody who might be getting ECT, or you're a family member, or you're a therapist, or maybe even a psychiatrist who finally wants to be armed with information, you can go to ectresources.org and get a brochure, a color brochure that you can mail to people, hand to people, that summarizes why no one should ever get ECT. You can get a little introductory page, the same brochure, but as just a page. You can get a few key introductory articles to the subject. And if you want to go further, and I can't tell you how much work this took, you can get over 125 scientific articles available right there that will give you all the basis you need to research, to understand in a deeper way the harm done by ECT. And you'll also get along with it a glossary of search items so that you can search women, you can search children, you can search abuse, you can search memory loss or brain damage or controversy. It's a resource that I hope will help to bring to a halt this barbaric approach to human beings. So I'm really glad to have it up finally. It took me hundreds of hours of work, and Ginger pitched in to create the website. My assistant worked hard to clean up the PDFs. My researcher helped obtain them. So I want to thank Missy, my assistant, and I want very much to thank my researcher for all of his anonymous help with this. I think I can give his first name, Ian, very much for the work that went into this project. It's up. It's there forever, hopefully. And it will be updated periodically. People can send in new ideas to add to it. So that for a recent, dismal, trying, but important work. And now I want to introduce to you Joanne Cacciatore. Joanne is someone that I love, my wife loves. She's someone who's put her heart and soul into the area of helping folks directly, From her own personal experience, Joanne discovered that the bereaved are some of the least cared for and most run from people on the face of the earth. I can remember Joanne as a child, not such a child, in high school when a friend of mine lost her mother. I was unable to reach out to her. I remember this, still remember poignantly, unable to go to the funeral. It was too much for me to deal with. Well, Joanne deals with it head on. She has formed the MISS Foundation, MISS, the MISS Foundation, which has conferences and deals with this around the world and has groups, MISS Foundation groups around the world. She's at the University of Arizona, where she has the Center for Loss and Trauma. She's among the most caring human beings on the face of the earth. In reviewing her credentials, I noticed that she'd gotten the St. Teresa Compassionate Care Award. Believe me, she deserves it. Hello, Joanne. How are you today out in Arizona?
It's a little warm out in Arizona, but that's what Arizona's about.
It's gorgeous here in upstate New York. It's a perfect day.
I was supposed to be there in person. I remember that, which would have been just lovely. But thank you for having me by distance. I'm happy to be here talking with you today.
How about briefly talking about the relationship, if any, between your Center for Loss and Trauma at Arizona, your MISS Foundation, just your overall way of reaching out to the universe, which is a very large and caring and loving way.
Yeah, well, I'm a professor, assistant professor at Arizona State University. My area of research is traumatic grief and death, and so I work with and research amongst families in all cultural groups and across all regions of the world whose babies and children have died or are dying, who have experienced homicide and suicide, primarily anachronistic deaths. So, it's the tough field. People kind of, even in academic circles, people kind of cringe and go, oh, you know, that's a tough thing to research. And it is, but it's also incredibly valuable and worthwhile. Through the Center for Loss and Trauma and the MISS Foundation, we provide mentor and clinical services for families, case management, who come in directly to us. That's for parents who lose children or whose children are dying. And so we have, the foundation has 77 HOPE mentors and support groups in different 77 cities around the world. So our reach is pretty far. Our website's getting about 1.5 million hits a month.
Oh, my Lord.
There's a huge gap. There was a huge gap for families, and often people just didn't know where to turn. They had nowhere to turn. And unfortunately, our families are not being treated very well from oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes from the medical community. So we provide a lot of services to families from, conferences and retreats, counseling services, peer mentorship. We have 27 online support groups as well as in-person support groups around the world. We have a very active Facebook page, lots and lots of people. We do a lot for families, not just parents, but grieving siblings as well and grandparents. So it's really a family support network community, if you will. And that's kind of how they piece together a little bit. My particular area of research, as I said, is traumatic grief and death. And so, oftentimes people find me through either my research or my practice, but end up kind of becoming part of a larger community. And really, there's a lot of power in that. There's a lot of power in connecting with other people who have been through a similar experience as you have and who get it in a different way. Because, how do you explain, how do you put to words what it's like to bury a child? I don't know that you can. So when you're in the room, either a metaphorical room in terms of the internet, so you're connecting with others on the internet through our website presence, or in person at one of our support groups, or at a conference or at a retreat that we hold, any of those means through which we can connect with other people is a pretty powerful way of connecting us with others, and that's healing by itself.
Well, God bless you for what you do, and it's a miracle how you relate to people. I went to was invited to speak at one of Joanne's conferences and addressed people about the problems with psychiatry and the nature of grief and bereavement, and shared some of my own experience with it, which I felt was so paltry compared to the death of a child. But my own experience was greeted warmly and caringly. And Joanne just spreads throughout her life, in this case throughout her conference, an environment of love and care that is really, really profound. And one of the things that I was genuinely humbled, and I don't say that lightly. I was genuinely humbled at presenting to this group that had been through so much and had to search deep into myself to find what it is I wanted to contribute. And Joanne was very helpful to me about that by looking at some notes, because I don't usually even make notes that I made for the talk, and looking at me and saying in their lovely way, "Well, I just wish they'd get to know you," meaning this is not good. Start over again, be yourself. And it worked very, very well, bless you. One of the things that I think might be helpful to people is to talk about how do you as a person deal with so much grief on a daily basis? How do you do that?
Yeah, well, I have a pretty committed mindfulness practice. So mindfulness in the literature, there are a couple things about mindfulness. Mindfulness in general, there's this general kind of definition of mindfulness that comes from the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn out of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Institute at UMass. And basically the definition, by Kabat-Zinn's definition, is it's a state of being in the present moment with intention, fully present, non-judgmentally. And so it's a tough thing to stay fully present with grief, a very, very tough thing to stay mindful willingly in the presence of human suffering. And so my mindfulness practice is day to day, all day long. I try to practice mindfulness. I try to practice mindful eating, mindful walking, mindful communication, mindful gazing at nature, mindful listening to the bells chime. You know, I try to be in the present moment. I have a practice, the barefoot hiking practice that I employ that is a little wonky for Arizona, but I still do it anyway. And here's the thing about being in the present moment. Being in the present moment means that we take care of what's happening right now. We don't ruminate on the past. We don't experience anxiety about the future. In the future being, 5 seconds from now, or 1 year from now, or 10 years from now. We're present moment oriented rather than past or future oriented. So that is really useful for me in my work, because I can be fully present with someone who's suffering and feel their sadness and their pain, and at the same time realize that in 3 hours I need to go home and I need to take care of myself. I need to do the things that allow me to continue my work. And sometimes that means, taking a hike. Sometimes that means eating well. Sometimes it means spending time with my friends and family. Sometimes it means, it depends on the day. It means different things. But I'm very, very good at self-care and paying attention to what's happening in the moment. So when I'm sitting across from someone who's suffering, I'm not thinking about dinner. I'm not thinking about how, oh my goodness, they had a 16-year-old who died and I have a 16-year-old and what if he dies? I'm not doing any of that. I'm joining them in their suffering. And, we did a study. It was just a pilot study, but it was a really interesting pilot study. And what we found, my research assistant, Kara Thielman, who's fantastic, what we found was that the volunteers who are trained in a mindfulness-based bereavement care model, so what we look at, when we look at, for example, clinicians, doctors, nurses, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, they have a very, very high, what we call compassion fatigue rate. So they burn out, in other words, quickly. And when we're burnt out, we're less compassionate with others, we're less tolerant, we're less empathic, because we feel this need to kind of, in a sense, build a barrier between ourselves and the other. And we did a very, very small pilot study where we looked at volunteers and clinicians who were trained in a mindfulness care bereavement model. And what we found was that it was protective, that not only did they have lower rates of burnout, lower reported, self-reported burnout, but also they had higher satisfaction with their lives. They had higher quality of life. So here they are working in one of the most high-stress, emotion-laden fields, that is, the death of a child. And yet mindfulness can be protective. That's pretty impressive. That's pretty impressive. The paper was just accepted for publication, is actually in press in a journal called Social Work.
Wow. Now you do your work through the university when you're doing therapy or on your own. Tell us about that, because you're unique in how you approach helping people, just economically, financial arrangement.
Yeah, well, it's by donation. So they make a donation to the Miss Foundation so that we can continue our work. So, we don't do insurance because, and it's not through the university, it's through the Miss Foundation, and we don't do insurance because insurance require us sometimes to say things that aren't true. If you're providing a code, if I'm working with a bereaved parent and they're bereaved because their child just died 3 months ago, but they're displaying symptoms like crying, deep regrets, feeling sleep disruption, eating disruption, feeling worthless, blaming him or herself, which is very common in bereaved parents, feeling like they don't want to live anymore, which is also very common in bereaved parents. It's hard to face a world where the most precious thing you've ever known is gone. And so if we bill insurance companies, we're, in a sense, in a bit of a quandary. We're required to make a diagnosis, basically. And so sometimes that would require us to say things that weren't necessarily true or that we didn't believe clinically were true. So a parent could be in grief and not have major depressive disorder. And we are, for purposes of the Miss Foundation, we don't feel that it's ethical or moral to basically lie and say someone is depressed when, in fact, they're grieving normally over the death of their child. If that makes sense.
Well, it's going to make a lot of sense to a lot of folks listening to this. So if you accept donations, and how many hours a week are you actually talking with people where you're helping somebody with grief? And related to that, how do you earn a living if you do?
Well, that's not my source of income. I do that. I do this work gratis. So my income comes up obviously from the university. But we have through the foundation, we have a clinical center where people come in and get counseling. And so we have two full-time counselors or part to full-time counselors, and then we have several interns each semester who we do intensive training with. They have to take a course before they can work with our families. They have to take a course from me, an intensive course that I teach through the university, and they have to pass that satisfactorily. And then they work with our families, and then they have us. We have a sliding scale at the clinic, basically. So if you can only afford $20, then you pay $20. If you can afford $30, you pay $30. If you can afford $100, you pay $100.
And you're not using insurance again at the clinic?
We don't.
I just hugely admire the purity by which you've chosen to live. It's really lovely.
Thank you.
Oh, golly.
Well, it just feels, it feels like a contradiction of my basic moral premise upon which I live, and that is not to cause further harm to particularly the most vulnerable. And grieving people are extremely vulnerable. I mean, if you have a newly grieving person, it's been a month since you know, since her, you know, 16-year-old died in a car crash. And the family is reeling from this. The whole family is upside down and inside out. And that parent goes to a counselor or to a therapist and says, I need help. It's wrong that the only way that that person can get help that they can afford is by lying to an insurance company or by pathologizing what is normal, what is because of love. We mourn because we love. So we shouldn't have to lie and say this is major depressive disorder and throw a label on it of something that it may well stay with this person his or her entire life.
Wow. Now, you've worked a lot on the DSM. You actually tried to exert a lot of pressure on the DSM people to not include bereavement as a disorder. Would you talk about that with us, please?
Yeah, sure. Well, the DSM-3 allowed what's called a bereavement exclusion. And so the bereavement exclusion basically gave you 1 year, 1 year after the death of a loved one, to have the same. I mean, the problem is that grief and bereavement look so much alike, so much alike. Grief and depression look so much alike. So if you look at the checklist for major depressive disorder and you understand what grief does to people, they're virtually indistinguishable. Virtually indistinguishable for a deep grief, for an intimate relationship between parent and child, or a conjugal relationship, or a parental relationship. Not necessarily for people to whom we are not particularly attached. But when you have high attachment, you have high distress when the attachment is broken. So for certain relationships, if you look at depression and grief, they're virtually indistinguishable from each other. So the DSM-3 said you have 1 year to grieve after the death of a loved one, and then if the symptoms are still so intense and continuing, you can be diagnosed with a mental disorder, which is major depressive disorder. So it gave you 1 year. Now, the CAPAs for reliability and validity, you see the 3 is certainly higher. In field testing, the CAPAs were, I think, 0.82 for the DSM-3 criteria for major depressive disorder. Okay, so the DSM-4 looked at, a single study. And that single study alone caused the committee to desire to reduce the time from 1 year to 2 months. So you had 2 months to mourn, and if you had not resolved those symptoms of mourning, then you could be diagnosed with a mental disorder after 2 months. That the CAPAs on that were 5.56. So even less reliable.
Explain CAPAs.
A measure of reliability in research, basically. So so 0.82 is better than 0.56. 0.56 is better than what we have now with the DSM-5 in field tests, where it was 0.32, I believe. So we're going the wrong direction. You know, we want to be headed toward 1, and instead we're headed toward 0. So the DSM-5 basically removes the bereavement exclusion. So after 2 weeks, you can be diagnosed with a mental disorder if you have ongoing sadness, crying, changes in sleep or eating, loss of interest in things, you know, feelings of guilt or regret. This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. We have pathologized what it means to be human and to love. Such indignity that I find it incredible. I find it offensive. And their reasoning is, well, people can get treatment that way. Well, you know, let's define treatment. Let's operationalize treatment. If by treatment you mean psychiatric medications, if by treatment you mean, you know, to be labeled with a disorder that's a myth, that's not true. Grieving people, grief is not depression. To mourn someone you love is a natural and necessary part of the human experience. So, it causes me a great deal of consternation, obviously. and, of course, I gave it my best shot to try and sway committee members to not make this what I thought was a really, really terminal mistake, and I don't. They obviously were not swayed. And so the DSM-5 was released, and basically, you know, you can be diagnosed with a mental disorder 2 weeks after the death of a child. I mean, I have a family I work with, a beautiful, beautiful family, whose 15- and 16-year-old children were hit on the freeway. Not their fault. They were rear-ended, and there was a gas explosion, and their children were killed in the car. How do you tell someone sitting beside you 2 weeks after something like that, that they have a mental disorder because they feel guilty, because they don't want to live, because life isn't worth living anymore, because they can't eat, they can't sleep? Are you serious? What kind of inanity would think that that's a good idea?
Now, one place in which you and I have talked about this, you and I have a different emphasis in our work, is that I believe that everything you've just said applies to everybody who's suffering. So that, and you may too. It's just our work has diverged. But I just wanted to clarify that I believe all of what Joanne Cacciatore is saying, and I believe it's true for all human beings. That if you get to know anyone who is profoundly suffering emotionally, spiritually, and you learn their story, you can't help but say that. But for the grace of God, go I. This is a human experience. You may be hearing voices, you may be seeing things, but I can't tell you that I wouldn't be doing the same if I'd been through what you've been through. And so I throw out the whole book. But Joanne has a very particular mission, and I think we're very comfortable with each other's emphasis.
Yeah, it's true. I can say that I've lost both my parents. By the time I was 37, I lost both my parents to death. And I lost my best friend, and I've lost, you know, partners. I've lost a lot of important people in my life. Quantitatively and qualitatively different for me than losing a child. And I think that's why it's so important for me in terms of the DSM, because bereaved parents are at particular risk of being vulnerable for misdiagnosis.
Yeah.
Because of their intense and prolonged suffering. And this is supported by the research. I mean, there's been research. Sanders did research in the 70s, and where she looked at conjugal grief, she looked at parental grief, and she looked at a general grief and compared the groups. Studies as far back as the 70s show that bereaved parents have more enduring and more intense symptomatology. Now, certainly human suffering, absolutely, but that's not my area of research. So my area of practice and research is this very specific area of specialization.
Right.
But a particular concern to me is that because bereaved parents have such enduring and prolonged symptoms, they are at an increased risk of psychiatric intervention inappropriately.
Yes, I imagine there's a lot of electroshock treatment. In fact, tied back to my introduction about putting up the ECT Resources Center,
right.
Finally, there's a lot of overlap there. We're going to go to break in a minute. One of the things I'd like to continue talking about is, let me say first, I've learned a lot from you, Joanne. I want folks to know that Joanne's understanding of the bereavement experience in terms of losing children has been very, very instructive and important to me. When we come back, talk more about folks who go through this and how long-lasting it is and what the process of going through it is like. And I know you don't speak of recovery. I don't think you speak of the process. And I'd like to hear more from you about that as we return.
Absolutely.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, returning with my much-loved and highly esteemed friend, Joanne Cacciatore. Joanne, how should people get in touch with you?
Oh, well, let's see. There are lots of ways. You can Google me. It's probably the easiest. Through the university, of course, through ASU, I have a Facebook page, I have Twitter feed, I have a LinkedIn feed. I have the centerforlossandtrauma.com website, and of course missfoundation.org if you've lost a child or if your child has been diagnosed tragically with a terminal illness.
let me ask, how does ASU respond to you and your work?
Oh, they're fantastic. I work in such a terrifically collegial environment. My co-investigators, I have a couple co-investigators there at the university. We're looking right now, Dr. Tushin and Mendoza and I are looking at substance abuse and trauma in bereaved parents. And so I work with a lot of my colleagues, but, you know, also just in general, they support the work. They think it's important work. They feel like there aren't enough people in academia doing this work. And there aren't, indeed. There aren't enough people in practice doing this type of specialization, unfortunately. You know, we have a very slim list of local resources for bereaved parents for therapy and counseling.
You know, as I look back on my own practice over the years, I don't think a lot of people have come to me during an acute bereavement process over many, many years of being in practice. Have I been just missing it, or do you think that's the case for most therapists?
It might be the case. I mean, a lot of times bereaved parents are scared to go to therapists who have not been through the experience. They feel like people will think they're crazy, and so they can be reluctant to seek therapy because they're afraid of being pathologized, of feeling like what they're experiencing is abnormal. Not all of them, certainly, and there are certainly some therapists who are good, who are just natural empaths. You know, who might have a child at home and just be able. I mean, really, there's no fix for this. I mean, that's the problem, right? I mean, we want fixes. We want to fix people. We want to make people better. We want to help people to be happy. No, you can't. You can't. That can't be a goal of therapy when someone's lost a child. You can't make being happy a goal of therapy when someone's lost a child, because for that parent, that may not be their goal. Their goal is just to be able to live again. Happiness is an outcome of figuring out, how do I live again? It's not that people don't become happy again. I mean, my child died in 1994. It'll be 19 years in July. And there's not a single moment of any day, of any week, of any year that passes when I don't miss her in my life. Yet, I'm wildly happy. I am absolutely wildly happy and always grieving at the same time. And that's important for bereaved parents to know, that they don't have to relinquish their grief and their sadness in order to be happy and lead a full life again. So happiness is an outcome of being with the grief.
You know, I mentioned earlier that I've kept learning from you, and I tend to generalize and to think about that all of life has a strong element of grief along with the happiness.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, I'm 77. I clearly imagine when I'm not around anymore, when I lose the life, or, God forbid, Ginger before me, even though she's younger with the illnesses she's had, almost lost her once already. And so I kind of live with that sense that life is this incredibly complex experience of moving toward death all the time and living life fully all the time.
Right. But that's exactly true. And when you're aware of death being around the corner, you live life more fully. That's the great secret. That's what I tell my students. I teach a traumatic death course at ASU, and I say, you know, people might want to avoid talking about death and trauma, but the truth is, when you talk about it, that's when you live life more fully, because you realize how fleeting life is. You don't want to waste any time. You want to make sure that you have no regrets. You want to make sure that you live every moment in the best way you can, in the most beautiful way you can. You leave your imprint on the world in a big and beautiful way, or maybe a sublime way, but you still make the most of what you have, of your gifts, in every moment. And, you know, because otherwise, you know, you just take everything for granted. I mean, you just do. When you've had it all and you think all that you have will last forever, what is there to appreciate?
Very, very well said. Talk some more about this process of of the grief and how you behave as somebody that people are calling often on the phone, from what you've told me, and turning to you for the help, treating you like therapists, I'm sure, at times. And what is that like? What are you doing? What are you doing with folks?
Oh, wow. You know, it just depends. You know, I'm not a standardization kind of person. I believe strongly in science. I'm a scientist. I research. But I think research is science-based, and I think counseling and therapy is arts-based. I think it's an art, and I think anytime we try to operationalize it in the sense that we try to protocolize something, we make a checklist, I think we get in danger, because no two people and no two service, if I'm working with two families, three families, and all three families have experienced the death of a baby to sudden infant death syndrome, to SIDS, they're all still different. They have some features that are alike, but one family might be Sikh, and one family might be Jehovah's Witness, and the other family might be Catholic or atheist. One family might be affluent. One family might be poor. One family might be immigrant. There are so many things that we need to consider when we're working with people, that when we make the checklist for therapy, when we say, this is the tool that I'm going to use with every single family, that's why you're not effective. I mean, perhaps it's the therapy that's not effective, not the person who's broken. And so when we treat therapy like an art, and we come to each family, each circumstance, as a blank slate, tabula rasa, and we say, I don't know where we're going to go, but I'm going to join you in your darkness and you won't be alone. That's where the magic can happen, because anything that happens is going to be specifically for this individual sitting in front of you, or this family sitting in front of you. So what I do is I hold on for the ride, and I try, and I'm present as much as I can, and I extend to them civic love, and I'm not afraid of their darkness, and I'm not afraid of their pain, and I'm not afraid of their emotion, and I'm not afraid when they say, you know, I feel like I'm going to die, and I bring to them, the relationship with them, the best of what I have to bring. That seems to be good for people, and it seems to be good for me too, because I'm giving them all that I have. And, you know, contrary to what people think, when you give someone all you have, that doesn't mean you're at a deficit. It means actually that you're going to get back more than you gave. So it's regenerative.
You're giving a lovely description of the heart of what I feel is the heart of being helpful, in the heart of empathic help.
Yeah.
I love that. That you you go into the darkness with them and they're not alone anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the point isn't to avoid the darkness. The point is to have someone join you there so that you can tolerate being there, so it's not so frightening and overwhelming. The darkness has things to teach us. Wendell Berry, one of my favorite authors, writes a lot about that. He says something like, I go and sit, you know, he's talking about being in the wilderness, you know, in the dark, and that can be very, very frightening. And he says, I go and I sit and I'm still and I feel the fear, and I'm aware that I'm feeling the fear, and then I just relax into it and I start listening to nature and I let it become part of me, and then what I fear leaves, and then I hear its song. And there's a lot of truth to that as it relates to our dark emotions, our grief.
I think a lot of what goes wrong in psychiatry is that the people who are trained in medicine and go into psychiatry are afraid of the darkness. They're afraid to be with people in darkness. And I think it's one of the reasons they end up doing horrible things to people, because they're afraid to be there in the darkness with them. They want to get rid of it.
Oh, sure. We want to avoid especially death, especially the deaths of children. I mean, there are few moments where providers will avoid people that match the death of a child or a baby. I mean, providers are incredibly uncomfortable with that kind of suffering and trauma, particularly if they're parents. It's a very, very difficult, and even if they're not parents, it's it's hard to understand the depth of what that commitment is, that attachment. I mean, you know, from an evolutionary psychologist perspective, there's nothing worse that could happen to a human being. I mean, you know, your children are your, you know, your offspring are your genetic material. From an evolutionary perspective, I had a friend of mine who's an evolutionary psychologist, and he says to me, oh, yeah, from an evolutionary psychologist perspective, nothing's worse than losing your offspring because that's your genetic material. And so, of course, from an evolutionary perspective, you would have the strongest reaction to something like that because of that. Well, you know, it's hard for anyone to imagine. It's hard for someone who's a parent to imagine what it would be like to see your child laying dead and lifeless in a casket. It's, people don't even want to visualize it if they have children. They don't want to take their child and imagine their child in a casket. It's too painful to imagine. So if it's too painful to imagine, can you imagine what it's like every day you wake up, this is your reality? You know, and you can replace the child with your spouse, with any person you love more than you can speak, right? So I mean, it's death is permanent. It's an awful thing because it's permanent. It's irreversible. And in the moment when you're sitting across from that person contemplating their death, it's hard to imagine how permanent is, how forever is, you know. And so it doesn't really hit you. I work with parents whose children are dying, who think that they've had time to prepare. And then when they're, you know, even if their child was ill for many years before their child died, and then they say to me, yeah, I thought I was prepared, and then my child died, and I feel like it's hit me like a truck. I had no idea that it was going to hurt this way. I had no way to prepare for this.
Wow. One of the things that I've learned, been learning from you, and it's been quite an evolution for me, is about the loss of unborn children. I think I was quite cavalier about those things back in the 60s. People would, I've never talked about this on the air or actually anywhere. Women would come to me, and the only way they could get an abortion in our area was for psychiatric reasons. And I was reading feminist literature, and I was imbued with that. And I participated on, I don't know, two or three occasions in providing that medical evaluation that said that, you know, allowed a woman to get an abortion. And to me, you know, I wasn't stupid or thoughtless or totally insensitive, but I didn't get what a loss that can be, what a tremendous loss that can be. And I've been growing in that regard year after year about just treasuring life and how people do treasure life. And your group and the experience with you have really brought that further along for me. And perhaps you could talk about that, about the grief for people who lose unborn children.
Well, I mean, so the research suggests, and my practice suggests, that for some women, for example, a miscarriage can be a really, really big loss. Particularly women who have struggled with infertility, who may have been trying to get pregnant for 10 years and then finally got pregnant. I mean, you can just imagine, you know, there's a rating called importance of motherhood rating. So especially for a woman whose importance of motherhood is very high and who has struggled with infertility, if that woman has a miscarriage, suffers a miscarriage even early in the pregnancy, that can be a real devastating thing for that woman. Well, and then there's the death of a baby, you know, and this is something that's often misunderstood. This is not a miscarriage. This is a stillbirth. And so many babies in America especially, and we don't talk about it very much because it's sort of a public health secret because there's so much shame attached to it. How is it that in a first world country where we have top of the line medical care, our stillbirth rates are higher than many, many third world countries? Many third world countries. We are awful in our stillbirth rates here in the United States. And so you have a number of babies that are dying during or just before birth at full term. So these are viable babies born at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 pounds that are dying before or during birth. And so the grief of those mothers is incredibly palpable and incredibly, incredibly difficult. There's a lot of shame, a lot of self-blame. Oftentimes, they do an autopsy on the baby. They can't find a diagnosable cause of death in about half the cases. And so stillbirth is one of those kind of, it's been shrouded in secrecy for a long, long time, and that's kind of come out of the closet over the past decade or so. You know, lots and lots of changes with regards to how we as a society treat women who have experienced the death of a baby during or just before birth. Excruciating pain. I mean, look, childbirth by itself is painful enough when the outcome is good, and traumatic enough when the outcome is good. There is a dearth of literature, but still literature, on post-traumatic stress after childbirth, just because childbirth itself is daunting. I mean, think about what's happening to your body, and it's probably some of the most intense and acute pain that a human being can experience, childbirth. And on top of it, a dead baby. And then you have trauma on steroids. I mean, it's incredibly traumatic for these women, for these mothers. Then they go home. The nursery's already done. The car seat's in the car. They go home to an empty nursery. Their breast milk comes in. They didn't even get to bring their baby home in a lot of cases. It's a heartbreak. It's a heartbreak that's been really socially stigmatized and not treated as equivalent to the death of a child, and it absolutely is. The experience of the death of a baby during birth or just before birth is, when you look at emotional symptomatology, you see the same things. You see the same things. You see slightly more shame and guilt, actually, in this population than you do in others for the women, which I find interesting.
Yeah, how do they express the shame and the guilt? How do they blame themselves? What's their language for that?
I killed my baby. You know, my body failed. All I had to do was go to the hospital and have the baby, and my body did something wrong, and the baby died. So remember that in more than 50% of the cases, it's undiagnosable in terms of a cause of death. So if they can't find a cause of death, so the baby didn't have any genetic anomaly that was incompatible with life, then there's no medical malpractice, then who else is to blame?
Could become for a person the ultimate statement of they could never do anything right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it sets you up for a lifetime of contradiction with your body. I mean, you're in an adversarial relationship with your own body. How do you live in a body that did not bring life into the world like it was supposed to? And it's excruciating for these women. It's excruciating. And, you know, I've been working with these women for, you know, 16, 17 years now, and I've seen the devastation that it can cause, and that's why it's incredibly important for these women to get good social support and to not only have their motherhood validated, but their baby's life validated. Their babies lived, and they died, and they existed, and they matter. And we have to recognize that. When you decry that, when you say that baby never existed, that baby never mattered, what you're saying to the woman is, you never existed, you never mattered. A woman's identity is so tied up with her child.
Tell the audience some of the amazing work you've been doing in terms of changing legislation about birth certificates.
Well, as I was saying, you know, so basically as a society, we've been saying these children didn't exist. And so they would give them a death certificate. Well, you have an 8-pound dead baby, right? So you have to bury or cremate. There's a body. And, of course, in every state in the United States, there's mandated cremation or burial for these babies. So they get a death certificate, but they wouldn't give them a birth certificate.
They don't get a life certificate.
How can you say that someone died, but they never lived? How can you mandate final disposition, cremation or burial, for something or someone who never was? And so we began our work in the late 90s to change the law, and we've done so in 32 states or 33 states now, I believe. I just finished working with a woman, with our legislative liaison, whose son died 37 years ago in the state of North Carolina. and she never got to see or hold her baby back then. Even if the baby died, you know, hours or days after birth, they would take the baby out of the room if the baby was critical. Mom would never see the baby. They would go home. The family would take the nursery apart, and then people would pretend it didn't happen. And they would bury the baby, and Mom would never know where or when. It was just, they called it the rugby pass management of stillbirth. I mean, it was just hideous, hideous the way these women and these babies were treated. And so this woman, this happened to her and her son, and she called us and said, North Carolina is one of the states where you passed the legislation. Can I get a birth certificate for my son? And 37 years later, she wrote us a beautiful, beautiful letter saying, thank you so much. I've been validated as a mother. His life has been validated. You don't know what this means to me. It's just unbelievable.
I keep just thinking how profound your work is and your thinking and your feeling about all of this. We have maybe 4 minutes left. I'm sitting here thinking, where do I want to go with this? And I think I'd rather ask you, where would you like to go with the last few minutes?
Well, I think I would like to say thank you for your work. Because you have really paved the way for people who are suffering, even for bereaved parents, to, in a sense, empowered them to understand that they don't need a diagnosis, they don't need a pill to fix this. You can't. Some human suffering is unfixable in this world. This is one of them. And so, you've been the voice of that for a very long time, Peter. And, against the grain, against the bigger system. And it takes a lot of courage to do that. It takes a lot of courage to stand up against, the infrastructure, the systemic infrastructure of oppression, really, for people who are suffering, and say, no, this is not how we treat people who are hurting. We can't do this anymore. This is wrong. I mean, and it is wrong. It is wrong to say to someone, you shouldn't be feeling what you're feeling. Feel this instead by taking this pill. Feel this instead by listening to me, the expert. I mean, it's pretty arrogant. And so I just thank you, really, for the work that you do, because it's more macro, certainly, than my work. My work is an area of specialization. But your work is much more macro than mine, so affects many more people. And, just deep bows to you for that.
That's sweet. I had no idea that would be the response to my asking where you want to go. Did you initially... At some point, well, I'm sure you did. Tell us about what you ran into. We have 4 minutes, by the way. Tell us what you ran into. Some of the rejection and I'm sure ridicule that you've had for some of your views, especially I would think about the newly born children.
Yeah, I've encountered some less than compassionate feminist groups who have really been, which is interesting because I happen to be. Consider myself a feminist.
You're one of the most powerful women I've ever met in my whole life.
Well, thank
I'd rank you,
for you
that. There with Ginger.
Thank you. So I've run across a lot of opposition from feminist groups, and sort of nasty opposition, not honest opposition. I'm okay with an honest debate, but I'm not okay with being blindsided, and I'm not okay with some of the things that have occurred with some of the feminist groups behind the scenes, in terms of lobbying against our efforts. We have no ulterior motives here. Our motives are simple. Parents whose children die during or just before birth have to give birth to their dead baby. They deserve a birth certificate, period. 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 There's no discussion. There's no debate about what birth is and what birth isn't. Birth is a biological event. You see it happen. The birth of a baby who's died 5 minutes before birth, or the birth of a live baby, they're no different physiologically. No different, except that the baby who died might be more physically painful and certainly emotionally more painful. The breast milk, the process is still the same. So I've had a lot of opposition from some pretty Goliath feminist groups. I've encountered opposition from even within, you know, my own circles where I have to argue that, look, you know, philosophically, you may believe that life begins at the moment of conception, and that's fine. But a miscarriage is not a birth. Losing a baby at 8 weeks, gestation, is not a birth. Losing a baby at 40, but physiologically, we have to draw the line somewhere. And so, I mean, there are people who are upset with me because of, you know, because their positions are just the opposite, yeah, the other direction. And I think we have to be reasonable.
I miscalculated, and we are ending now.
Okay.
Bless you for your work. Thank you for your life, your existence. And thank you for continuing to teach me about the importance and depth of life. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. Love you, Ginger.